have a quorum yet, but we're going to start anyway. We're trying to start on time, which is 5 minutes late, and it's 10 minutes late, so we're going to start. Today we're going to talk about homelessness, an overview, and Wildlife Foundation is the presenter. Who's going to do it? Welcome to the committee. You're playing for the tape and five of the members.
All right.
And we're looking forward to it. I will note that the Wilder Foundation does a lot of wonderful work and is a great assistance to me.
Thank you very much.
Should be to the rest of the committee. I know we took a tour last session, and there was a place that the Wilder Foundation had for single adults.
Yes.
And they were fixing it up, and they were great.
I was actually over there yesterday. My name is Greg Owen, and I'm a consulting scientist with Wilder Research Center. This is Ellen Shelton, my colleague. She's a research scientist there as well.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Distinguished members, visitors, guests, would you like me to begin, or would you?
Please do.
All right. Thanks. First of all, I appreciate very much the opportunity to have a chance to talk with you today about the research that Wilder's been involved in related to homelessness in Minnesota. Wilder was first asked to become involved in research in this area in 1984. That was when Jim Scheibel was a councilman in St. Paul, so it's a long time that we've been involved in this kind of research. In 1991, Commissioner of Housing Finance at that time, Jim Solem, asked if we would consider conducting a statewide survey of homeless people. It was a big jump to move from a local metro area study to a statewide study, but we agreed to do it with some important financial backing from some private funders, including the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, represented here today. Warren Hanson is here, I think will provide some testimony, and also the Family Housing Fund, and Angie is here, also representing that group. It's been a really, I would say, terrific public-private partnership involving people from a wide variety of backgrounds, inquiring into the conditions of homelessness in the state of Minnesota, and we've been really grateful for that support, including the support from Housing Finance, the Department of Human Services, and also the Veterans Affairs. I won't tell you a lot of details about the study, but for those who may not be familiar, it is one of the unique studies in the United States in that we use 700 volunteer interviewers trained by satellite television to conduct 30-minute interviews face-to-face with homeless people around the state. We conduct more than 2,500 interviews in one 24-hour period, and the way in which we do that is by going to all of the shelters, all of the battered women's facilities, all of the transitional programs, all of the facilities that fit the federal definition of homelessness, and ask people to participate in face-to-face interviews. We give them a compensation of $5 when they participate in the interview. Our response rate is in the range of 90% or higher based on both the way in which we conduct the study and I think also the fact that there are all volunteers out there. They know that none of the people asking these questions are being paid or compensated and that we are really interested in the situation of those who are experiencing homelessness. And I think that's part of what contributes to the success of the study. Let me go to the basic facts. The first study statewide in 1991 found not quite 2,000 adults who are homeless in the shelter facilities and 900 children who are homeless in the shelter facilities. That contrasts with the most recent study. We do the study every 3 years. The most recent study conducted in 2003 found 4,150 adults in the shelter facilities, including transitional programs, and 2,865 children. Of course, by the end of the 90s, compared to the beginning of the 90s, women and children together outnumbered men in the shelters. That was not true at the beginning of that decade. We've also been successful in identifying and interviewing people who are homeless and on the streets or in other locations not intended for shelter. In the 1991 study, we interviewed 118 people in shelter, in non-shelter locations, I should say. But by 2003, we interviewed 796 people that were not sheltered. I don't want to in any way represent that as a count of all of the people on the streets. There's no sampling list for homeless people. Researchers are challenged very significantly when we're trying to figure out ways of enumerating. And so those are not complete counts. In fact, what has happened is we have gotten better at getting out into street locations and identifying where people are likely to be and interviewing them. Nonetheless, there is no question that over that period from 91 to 2003, there's been a significant increase in homelessness for children, a jump of about fivefold in their total numbers represented. I think one thing that typically is disturbing to individuals when we talk about children that are homeless is that the average age is between 6 and 7 among those that are with their parents. And so that is, I think, a really particularly vulnerable time and bears our interest. If I could just make a few key observations and point out some of the materials that are in the packet. I hope we haven't inundated you with the materials when you've been doing research like this for, you know, over 13 years statewide. You do accumulate a lot of materials. What I've tried to represent in the packet and with Ellen's help, who prepared, I think, what is an excellent one-pager, this thing front and back is probably what I'm going to be speaking about mostly today. This is the Homelessness in Minnesota Highlights from the 2003 statewide study. Ellen took it upon herself in the last few days to put as many facts as she could possibly put on one piece of paper, albeit two sides, that would be able to be accessible and at least in the friendliest manner that we could. So if you might take a look at that as I'm talking about the next set of points. First, I would point out that, the population of those that are homeless, those experiencing homelessness in our state, is a very heterogeneous population. It is not a single cloth. And as a consequence, the likelihood of addressing the problems of people that are homeless with a single kind of solution is not really feasible. There is a wide range of, distress in this population, and that really brings me to my second point. As a researcher, what I've observed over the last 12 years is that it's almost like we have the population of those that are homeless in a crucible. It's like we've been heating it up and we've been concentrating the level of distress. And the things that I would point to when we're focusing on this concentration of the level of the distress is the types, range of difficulties and distress that we see in the characteristics of those that are in shelters and on the streets. We see most particularly a significant increase in the percentage of persons with serious and persistent mental illness. Back at the beginning of the 90s decade, we were seeing rates of about 20 to 25% persons with serious and persistent mental illness. Now our rates are, 47%. This is a very serious concern. As most of you know, the Community Mental Health Act in the early 70s was intended to deinstitutionalize people with serious mental illness and provide opportunities for them to get accessible outpatient treatment. The difficulty is that the Community Mental Health Act was expecting that there would be places for people to live and that they would be able to afford places to live and perhaps get other supports they would need in the community. The promise of the Community Mental Health Act has simply not been realized. And when we look at a population of homeless people in the state of Minnesota, where as many as half have a serious or persistent mental illness, I think this is a grave cause for concern. It represents a problem in a number of areas, but it also means that the decisions that you would make as legislators about a whole range of issues will likely affect this population. Another thing to point out, in the 2000 study, we saw something quite remarkable. It was the highest rate of employment that we had ever seen in the homeless population. We found that over 40% were employed at least some hours each week, and that almost a quarter of the population, 24%, were employed full-time, and our definition was 35 hours a week or more. So we had one quarter of the homeless population employed full-time in 2000. To show how sensitive this population is to economic downturns, from 2000 to 2003, the percentage of persons employed full-time dropped by half. That is, we went from 23% to 13% who were employed full-time at the time of the 2003 study. This shows just how sensitive populations already at the margin may be to economic downturns and to when employers have more opportunity to be discriminating about who they pick for their employees and when there are fewer jobs available. And as a consequence, that means, of course, that people that are homeless have less dollars to expend, less likelihood to be able to afford the small amount of affordable housing that might be available. The current economic circumstances, I think, do not bode well for the 2006 study, which Dave Schultz from the Department of Human Services just asked me if we were going to start planning today. We have flat wages. We have skill demands up by employers and housing costs up. And I think those three things do not bode well for the 2006 results.
I think just borne up today, I heard news that the economy is gaining, we're creating more of a surplus. We're getting money in the Department of Revenue. However, the number of people being employed is getting to be more. Unemployed is more.
Yeah.
So that kind of tells me that the people on the bottom are the ones that aren't working.
Right.
And that kind of...
And the increased skills that the employers are looking for, I think, again, in this population, and you'll see, I think there's some educational information on your sheet, about 25% haven't graduated from high school. Well, you combine that with other types of disabilities. We've got one question that we asked in the most recent survey was about brain injury. We got a request for to add several questions to the survey about possible brain injury, which we had never had in the survey before. And so we asked a sequence of questions. They're not diagnostic questions per se, but they're a reasonably good estimate of whether or not a person likely has a closed head injury that causes persistent problems. Well, we found that the percentage in the population that fit the criteria was 29%, which, again, when you begin to add up the kinds of disabilities or difficulties that people can have, and we provided to the Governor's Task Force on Long-Term Homelessness data related to disability, when we looked only at that population that were the long-term homeless, that is, they're homeless a year or longer, or the other part of the definition is they were homeless at least four times over 3 years, those individuals had much more difficulty with a range of service access, but more particularly 85% had some type of serious disability. 85% of those that are long-term homeless have a serious disability. I'm sorry, if you wish to interrupt me for questions, that's fine.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to look over the sheets here, and I'm confused here. I'm trying to find a number of homeless people on a given night or the size of the problem in a given year. And I can come up with what I guess is the annual estimate on this sheet of 3,288 people are sheltered in one night, any given night. But I'm not finding a number somewhere, so could you help me out?
Yes, thank you. And I do apologize for the confusing amount of material that we have. We have probably over 1,000 pages on our website posted related to this material. But specifically to your question, our single night count in 2003 was 4,150 that we enumerated. That is, those are people that we actually counted, 4,150 adults in shelters, and then 2,865 children in shelters.
You can point out the numbers on the back side of the
okay.
of the one pager.
On the page, one pager that says trends over the last 12 years, you can look down at the third black line, says the number of women and children levels off in metro area and still growing in Minnesota. You look at the 2003 column, the figure for the total sheltered individuals is 7,015, and then there's an additional 796 identified there in unsheltered locations. That's the single night count. Of course, let me just say a couple of things about making annual estimates, because I think you raise a really important question. A single night count when you do it as a cross-section, over-represents people that are in homeless shelters for longer periods of time, and it under-represents people that have shorter episodes. And so when you make estimates for annual population of people using these facilities, you have to account for those differences. Our absolutely lowest estimate of the number of people that are homeless over the course of the year in Minnesota is around 2,000. But when we really, in the 2003 study, we did very careful review of the literature. We examined all of the range of elements that should be taken into account when making the estimates. And we took into account information from the provider surveys that we conducted at the same time. The estimate went up as high as 50,000 over the course of a year who are experiencing homelessness. That includes men, women, and children, as well as youth on their own. The estimate that we have for youth on their own, and that report will be coming out within the next week, is between 12,000 and 22,000. Now that sounds like a terribly wide range, and it is, because it is extremely difficult to make annual estimates from single night counts. And consequently, when we describe the information, we talk about the 7,000 to 8,000 that are nightly homeless and are estimated 20 to 25, and depending on how you do the estimates, as high as 50,000 that are homeless over the course of the year. And I wish I could give you an answer that had a smaller range. Without spending an inordinate amount of money to study the problem, it is impossible to get narrower with that range. I hope that answers you.
Representative Slough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a similar question, but related to weather, frankly, in terms of, I would think the numbers would fluctuate in the winter. I mean, not that homeless people are going to winter in Florida, but I would think that they might think about going to a warmer location, and we've always heard about states or cities or somebody giving homeless people bus tickets to go to warmer locations. Does it fluctuate significantly by weather, and then are there significantly larger homeless populations in warmer states?
Both very good questions, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I can answer this question. One issue that we have is that there are very few other states in the United States that do studies like ours. And there are very few other places that have this public-private partnership built around doing routine information gathering about homeless people. We do have some recent studies, and we do know that the populations of homeless people in other states, some in warmer climates, are also high, especially in large cities in warmer climates. San Diego has a significant homeless population. One thing, however, we do not see in Minnesota is a significant change in the total population from winter to summer. I don't know that I have the complete explanation for that, but one of the things that the Department of Human Services in Minnesota does is a quarterly shelter count. And so we've been monitoring those counts over the last 15 years. It's rare that the fluctuation in the count, and their counts are very compatible with our count of about 7,000 on a single night at the present time. It's very rare that the count from winter to summer varies by more than 1,000 total persons represented.
I might add something.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. has conducted a few nationwide sampled surveys, and they did find that over a course of a week, looking both at the sheltered and unsheltered population, the use, their ability to find people, there were more homeless people found in February when it was colder, and they were more likely to be in shelters where it's easier to find them than in October, which is the time of year that we do our study. So we consider it likely, based on their sampling at different times of the year, that our counts are probably slightly conservative.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Shelton, would you give your name and the thing for the record so 100 years from now we know?
Very important for posterity to know. I'm Ellen Shelton,
research scientist
at Wilder.
Appreciate that. Representative Slower.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up question. Maybe you're getting into this, and I apologize. I was a little bit late. But one question I guess, and I don't know if other people get this when they're door knocking and things, is we get people that say they draw a correlation between homelessness and benefits, that people might stay in Minnesota because they're going to get either more shelter, more benefits, more food, you know, and I'm sure we've all heard that, and it's also drawn to other populations. Is that true? Is there anything better here, or a reason more people would be homeless here than somewhere else?
We do ask people if they didn't spend most of their time in Minnesota, or if they've come to Minnesota in the last 2 years, what were their reasons for coming? And when obviously we're only sampling people who are in Minnesota now, so we can't compare that with people who might have left Minnesota to go elsewhere. But when we compare what we find from people in our study to what the other studies elsewhere in the country have found, we find fewer people who say that they came here for specific services or shelter services or treatment services, and slightly higher percentage of people who say they came here because the economy was good and they were hoping to have jobs, or the same reasons that other people moved, because they had friends or family here. So it's definitely the case that people do come here for benefits, just as people do go anywhere else for what they know of in those other places. But we do seem to have a lower proportion of homeless people coming here for that reason compared to other parts of the country that the Urban Institute surveyed.
If I could have one follow-up on that.
Sure, Mr. Orr.
The other thing that we monitor is the proportion of persons in any given study year that have come to Minnesota within the last 2 years. And one thing that's interesting about that figure is it's either stayed relatively flat since the 91 study, or it's actually gone down. There, at any given time, about a quarter of the population that are homeless in Minnesota have arrived in Minnesota within the last 2 years. But even among that population, about a third are coming back here or have friends and relatives here that they're coming to be with.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, just since we're on this topic of people moving, you know, it wasn't too many years ago where counties actually had written policies that the way they dealt with homeless people in their county was to give them a bus ticket to the metro area. And I think that's not above board policies anymore, probably, because I think we raised some questions about that. I just remember hearing about where that was a Dakota County policy at one point.
In Martin County, we did it. Sioux Falls or Sioux City.
Okay. So I think it's not a public policy that people openly tell county commissioners and so on. But I'm just wondering what we do know about that. I know when I visited the shelters in my district, and I do have a number of them, sometimes we get into discussions about where people are coming from, and it often is other parts of Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if you... if we're tracking that, and maybe you are, and it's in what's coming, and if so, that's fine, I'll wait.
What's in your packet probably does not give a detailed description. What is on the website does give a detailed description at wilder.org, and I invite anyone to take a look at that stuff, but I'll just give you a short answer to the question, Representative Clark. What we've seen is that there is a primary draw from several cities. The cities, as you would expect, the cities that are closest geographically to the Twin Cities, and perhaps cities where there could be other reasons that might make a person exit. Gary, Indiana, Chicago, Illinois, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a couple of cities in North Dakota, St. Louis, Missouri, those are cities where we see some in-migration. But again, and this is not a point to be underrepresented here, we do not know very much about exiting Minnesota to be homeless elsewhere. We do know that it occurs. We know that other cities that do keep track or have conducted a study at some point in time identify people that have moved there from Minnesota. But it's not surprising that the range of places from which people move to be in the Twin Cities are cities that are close. I'll just describe one brief anecdote. One of the shelter providers in Chicago came up, spoke at a meeting of the Center for the American Experiment several years ago. Her name is Connie Driscoll. She was a nun. And she provided shelter to women that were crack addicted and were providing support for their families so that they could rear their children without having either get their children back or keep them with them if child protection was already involved. Connie had a bodyguard on her on the stage when she came. When she gave her speech at the Center for the American Experiment, a bodyguard stood behind her during the entire time period of the presentation. The reason that that occurred was because Connie was not safe in her home city. She was targeted by a number of the people that had interests in the women that she was sheltering. And they actually consolidated their building so that she would not have to go from building to building when she was providing her services. One of the things that is quite striking in the way in which people describe their reasons for coming to the Twin Cities is that they say, I think I have a better chance to get on my feet here. I think I have a greater likelihood that my kids are going to be safe in their schools here. I think I am likely to be safer if I stay here. So those are part of the explanation for why people in other locations might be coming to Minneapolis.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that information about people from out of state. My question was more, what do we know about people within other parts of the state being encouraged, given bus tickets, unspoken public policy, not so overt anymore, but coming into our shelters from greater Minnesota.
Thank you,
Representative.
We do know that some of that still occurs. There's no question from some of the interviews that we've conducted, people talk about coming here from other parts of the state. Generally, people that are homeless in greater Minnesota, that represents between a quarter and a third of the total population of homelessness in the state, those in greater Minnesota. Generally, that population is more homegrown. That is, there are fewer people that have migrated to those areas from other parts. The Twin Cities represents a higher proportion of people that have come from either other parts of the state or other states outside of Minnesota. I don't have at the top of my head right now the total percentage that have moved here from the other parts outside of the Twin Cities, but we could certainly get that for you. It's a relatively small percentage. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. I know one of the good trends has been that different regions have been developing their own shelters and transitional housing, and that's a very good trend, and I'm just wondering what kind of progress if we're tracking it. It sounds like we're not really tracking it too much.
We have specific data on the number of persons that have moved that are homeless in the Twin Cities that have come from other parts of Minnesota. We'll get that
okay.
for you.
Great, thank you.
You also have data from other parts of the state where there are shelters, and like Mankato has a couple shelters, I believe.
Right. When we conduct our interviews, we go to every shelter in the state of Minnesota. That's every battered women's shelter, every emergency shelter, and every transitional housing program. And we conduct interviews. Virtually everyone lets us do the study there. And as I reported, that there's a high response rate among the persons that are present when we go to conduct the interviews. And you're absolutely right. Minnesota has been investing much more significantly, particularly in transitional housing programs. Now, transitional housing programs, you remember, are those programs that provide longer periods of stay, typically anywhere from 6 months to can be up to 2 years. And those programs also provide other types of support services besides the housing to help people identify ways in which they can overcome barriers and likely maintain stable housing when they leave. We know that that is not working completely in the sense that we find in the last survey, and we presented this at the Supportive Housing Conference last year, that there were at least 700 persons in emergency shelter who had previously been in transitional housing programs. Mm-hmm. We think that that represents really an inadequate level of intensity of services for those persons that are in transitional housing programs, that the amount of service is simply not adequate to overcome the kinds of barriers that I've described earlier in this discussion, and consequently a number of those in transitional housing end up back in emergency shelter or on the street.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Owen, do we do any studies correlating family structure to homeless issues? And in particular, I was looking at, for example, here you talk about adults in correction facilities, 1991, 28%, 2003, 42%. And I know that I've read, for example, that people that have been in prison, typically it's about double for those that were not with their biological mom and biological dad together. And so what I'm wondering is if we do any studies related to that for long-term improvement of this issue. And in other words, I know what you guys are doing, I appreciate what you're doing, but you know, I think there's some root causes that are deeper that I don't see us talking about anyway. So I want to know if you'd measure that at all.
Yes, Mr. Owen. We do ask about families, whether or not people are accompanied by children in the shelters. We know that families in shelters are approximately 80% single-parent female-headed households of those that are in shelters today. We also know, as you pointed out, that there is a significant proportion and a growing proportion of persons that are exiting correctional facilities that are ending up in shelters. Again, it's very difficult to get housing if you're exiting correctional facilities. And really, the Department of Corrections is not really funded to provide any kind of transitional plan for people to... there is some work in jobs programs for correction people leaving correctional facilities, but there's really not a lot of additional support, particularly in the area of housing. I think your point about root causes is a very important one, and a cross-sectional study like this is probably not the adequate vehicle to talk about the range of root causes, but I think that there are some parts of our research that do at least help us to understand. One part of our research, the work led by Michelle Girard, who's with us today on our staff, is a study of homeless youth. We interviewed in the last survey 129 young people under the age of 17 that were homeless and on their own. So we asked them a series of questions. They were often staying in the squats, places not intended for habitation. Sometimes they were in shelters. When we look at this population, the youngest of which was 8 years old, living on his own, when we look at this population, we do ask questions about the characteristics of their home life. We find that about half of these children have come from circumstances of physical or sexual abuse. We also find that about 70% of these kids have been institutionalized previously. That is, that they have been in facilities of out-of-home placement of one type or another. We also know that a number of the, and I haven't talked about all of the characteristics of the population, a number of the children report that they are leaving homes where they feel it's just generally unsafe, or their parents are not paying a great deal of attention to them. One of the most troubling things in the 2000 study was the finding that of the children, of the adults that were in shelter, the young adults that were in shelter, we found that about 10%, a little bit less than that, actually had reported that they had been in shelters as children. And I think the most disturbing thing as it relates to long-term causes and to the extent to which we can address long-term causes, especially poverty, is that we have institutionalized the sort of the practical solution of shelters. And by institutionalizing this as a practical solution, we really are providing a kind of band-aid for support for persons that find themselves in these circumstances, but we don't do a lot in addressing those root causes that you're talking about. And it's a particularly troubling thing when you see now a new generation of young adults in the shelters who began their lives as homeless children.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And the reason I bring it up is I just feel like the more we can identify some of these root causes, the more we can deal with them long term. It's my opinion that with the huge rise in divorce in our culture, and some for valid reasons, but many for just not having the tools to stay together, it's impacting children, it's impacting the next generation, it's impacting mental illness, it's impacting everything. And that's why I'm hoping you study that. In particular, I think there's even a difference between the family structure where the man and woman have figured out how to work through their issues, stay together. I bet you that's quite a bit different from a kid that grew up with a stepmom or a stepdad with all of those issues. And so as a representative, I'm thinking, how can I, as a government person, try to help in here? But I really want data so that I know, you know, that we have an impact.
Just if I could make one more follow-up comment. One of the most troubling aspects of the, especially the experience for women who are homeless, the single most frequent reason
for women to be homeless in Minnesota is the domestic violence and spousal abuse. And so there are probably some good reasons why some of the partners that they may have partnered up with might not be good choices. And there is this kind of really serious consequence of both children being exposed to domestic violence, but then women suffering the consequences of this and trying to overcome it in their future work. I think there are a lot of things that people can do. You see a lot of foster families that are adopting children, or at least providing foster care to children that have basically had parental rights terminated and where there's care. But there are a lot of different families that can provide that kind of support, but probably not enough.
One last comment, I think domestic abuse is a terrible thing. We need to protect women, but I think it's 60 or 70% of all marriages end because of irreconcilable differences. It's not really some of the big things we talk about, and maybe that's the group that I'm most concerned about and how that impacts the next generation.
One last comment on that. I think that the other thing probably that's a little bit different in this population is that we have a lower rate of marriage. That a lot of the families that we see that have formed have not necessarily been formed in a married relationship.
Representative Westenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, on panel. On, you know, women homeless due to domestic abuse, I think that's really a critical area too, you know, to try to find some focus there, but and some help. But I kind of wonder too, you know, are there men homeless due to domestic abuse, or are there women homeless due to being abusers? You know, they're not included in this category or any reference for them, but that's just a thought. But my question to you really is, you mentioned the fact that as far as some of the children that have showed up in the need for care, again, were children that had been priorly institutionalized or helped somewhere along the line. Do you actually keep documentation of those people, or is this just a survey maybe that you did? And the reason for my question is, you know, I obviously want to help people, and, you know, it's that old adage, you can catch a fish and feed them for a day, or you can teach them how to fish and feed them for life. And obviously with children, they can't do for themselves yet. But I'm just wondering, do you keep figures on those types of things?
Chairman, the information that we have is derived from survey data, so that means that we're doing personal interviews with individuals. We don't receive documentation from them about their experiences. We do have a lot of other ways to examine our information and compare it to other data to see to test the veracity of what we're getting. The rates of institutionalization particularly the number of homeless children that have been in foster care is large. It's similar in other studies. And if you look at studies at the Institute of Poverty in Wisconsin, for example, of exiting from foster care, you found that there are substantial numbers of particularly older children that are exiting from foster care to homelessness, that the transition plans either are not fully affected or not implemented, or there are no transition plans. Exiting from foster care for children in this state is and in other states is a difficult thing, and especially for older kids that have been in a multiple number of foster care settings, those exits are not always smooth, and a lot of them end up in our counts. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask you, since you were talking about the youth, I believe last year, under the governor's recommendation, we defunded the one youth shelter in St. Paul for kids who had no place to go. And actually, our committee visited that shelter. I was shocked that it was cut out of the budget and recommended to be cut out after we had visited it. And saw that it was the only facility, I think, in St. Paul, maybe in the Twin Cities, for youth to go when they were homeless during the day and get some good food, get counseling, get networked into resources. It was a anti-prostitution type of opportunity for those youth who, you know, I think the testimony we've had in various committees that did not kill them with those bills is you leave a youth out in the street for if they're there for more than 48 hours and they're not in a shelter, the pimps will find them and they get into that whole system. And so it was such a good facility. And I'm just wondering now, do we see the youth who used to be served by that organization, maybe others around the state if there are others, do we see them more in the shelters, or did you find more prostituted youth, for example, or who might admit that they were or in danger of that in your shelters? Did you follow that? I don't see the numbers here, and I know that it was a concern when we were dealing with homelessness for youth.
We do ask, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we do ask a question in the survey related to whether or not young people have been approached for prostitution or dancing, and then we've also asked questions about whether they've done so. The numbers have not gone significantly up over the course of the study, but they've always remained much higher than you want them. And I can't recall the specific percentage that responded that way in the last survey. Michelle, I don't know if you know. Okay, we'll look it up for you. Just one other comment about that. There were more girls than boys, but the closure of shelters actually affects our ability to identify young people and interview them. This is the absolutely hardest population to count, enumerate, interview. They tend to be below the radar. They're typically not in places that you can find them easily. Oftentimes they're bouncing from friend's home to friend's home. They may be in a place not intended for habitation. They don't want to be known to authorities. And so when shelters close, we actually have a more difficult time finding and interviewing young people in these experiences. We definitely noticed in the last survey the closing of that facility, and we think that the counts partly represented we actually had a slight decline in the number of homeless young people that we interviewed, and we think that in part is represented by the fact that we did not have as many places to go to find them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Are there any other facilities like that right now that are still open?
Yes, there are some.
You want to put the chair up and welcome to our committee. You can give your name for the record. We can get another chair up here.
When we did the study in 2003, my name is Michelle Gerard. I'm a research scientist at Wilder Research Center.
Welcome.
Was still open. It closed right around that time. But some other facilities have closed, and we have noted that, I think as Greg was saying, that the number of beds for youth has gone down over the last 3 years since we did the study in 2000, fairly significantly. And I did look up the figure that you were wondering about in terms of, and this is youth report, so this is what the kids are telling us, so it might be less, but it was 13% of the girls under 17 and 4% of the boys who said that they had traded sex for shelter, food, clothing, etc.
And this is, Mr. Chase, under 14, did you say? What under what is?
Under 17 what? And under.
17. Thank you.
You know, that facility didn't have the capability of having that youth stay overnight. Is that correct, as I remember?
That's right.
It was just a day shelter, or they closed at a certain time. The one in St. Paul that we visited, I don't know if anybody knows which one it was. I can't remember the name of it.
It's now a coffee shop.
It's now a coffee shop?
Was it Safe
Does
Zone?
Does it function the same thing? Safe House? Was that?
There's Safe House and Safe Zone. There are two different safes.
Something like that.
Yes, Safe Zone then.
It was closed by lack of funding? Is that correct? Does anybody know?
Mr. Chair, we defunded it here.
We defunded it here?
It was a recommendation from the governor, as I recall, to cut a number of homeless programs. And I don't know, maybe we can get the exact... I bet you here's somebody who actually knows.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I think the funding you're referring to is the DHS Adolescent Transition Program. Which is much like the Emergency Services Transitional Housing Dollars, but it's specifically targeted towards youth. I believe in that there was about $1.2 million per biennium available for that, and those resources were put in the block grants that are sent to counties, but in counties trying to set priorities, many removed their youth programs.
Mr. Chair, and I'm correct that it was the governor's recommendation to cut that funding, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, yes.
Okay. I'm glad it wasn't our committee. I just remember that when I saw it, our committee had visited there, and it was such a, seemed like such a tragic, unproductive direction. So, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Sorensen, you want to continue? Mr. Representative Mahoney. We got a lot of questions.
I'm just going to comment that I'm glad that it wasn't us because my nightmares have been so bad this year already.
I don't want to put any guilt on you.
My mother did it well in her job. I'm looking through the Homeless in Minnesota 2003 and the more, many things that should alarm us as we come to the committee, but one of the things that's starting to frustrate me and alarm me even more is that when I look at the percentage of employed homeless and your numbers, they can, my dad was an accountant, we can make numbers look like just about anything here, but I'm going to guess at it, you know, from looking at them, that there's approximately 2,000 employed homeless people out there working, making somewhere between $8 and $10 an hour. And they can't afford a house. They can't afford a roof over their head. And I think that is really a bigger problem for us as a society and as a state. And I am not going to try to place blame on anybody. That's just something that we as a society have to try to figure out how we house people that are working and are working poor. Can you comment on some of the employment stuff and just go into that a little bit so that we kind of understand, because we are the jobs committee, and that's probably one of the best ways to get somebody from being homeless is getting a job that pays a wage they can get a house or a roof over their head.
Go ahead. Representative, Mr. Chair, thank you. The employment information from 2000 to 2003 was the most one of the most troubling trends that we saw. One was the drop in the percentage of people, that is how sensitive this population was to a more difficult economy. And so we have 30% that are employed, at least some now, but less than 13% that are employed full-time. But that does mean there are somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people that are homeless in Minnesota on a given night who are also employed in some way or another. Some of those jobs range from $6 or $7 an hour. Some are very irregular kinds of work. Some of it may be as high as $9 or $10 an hour. I remember interviewing at the Harbor Light Mission a sous chef who was an assistant in the kitchen at a restaurant in the downtown hotel. He was at a pay-per-stay facility, $4 per night, and as a sous chef, he was able to save a little bit of money by living in these circumstances, but he didn't have hopes of being able to find his own place to live for a year or more. I think there are similar circumstances around the shelters that we have both in the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota. There are people that are working, they leave the facility in the morning for a job, and then they come back, but their income is simply not adequate. One of the big gaps that we have in the state is this affordable housing gap. And I know some of the other speakers here today will speak to that. But specifically, if you look at the legislative auditor's report on this gap between wages and housing costs, you have to be up around $17 or $18 an hour if you're going to afford a two-bedroom unit. We looked at the disparities between what people were paying, what people could afford to pay compared to what they had available for housing. As you probably all know, this is one of the more expensive, the Twin Cities in particular, is one of the more expensive areas in the country, urban areas, to live housing-wise. And as a consequence, even people that are working cannot find a place that they can live and still have enough money to eat. I will maybe put one other comment. I just want to point one other recent project that Ellen has been involved in, as well as others at Wilder. The McKnight Foundation has been investing in a project called Families Forward over the last 3.5 years. The project has 17 sites around the state trying to advance low-wage workers. 16% of those low-wage workers were homeless at the time they began the program or in the period just before they began the program. The Families Forward initiative, which uses intermediary organizations to help employers get people matched up with jobs, to help low-wage workers find potential ways of getting training and move forward in the job market. The early results on that, the first 3-year results, are very promising. Ellen just completed a report on this to the McKnight Foundation. I think the information here is really helpful information for your committee. We'd be happy to provide it to you. It does show advances on average of wages of a dollar or more per hour for very low-wage workers, and even though a dollar isn't a huge amount of difference, it is in the right direction, and the programs are effective both in meeting the employer's needs and in meeting the needs of low-wage workers. So I do think it is an important thing to consider, not just whether people are working, but whether or not they have any opportunities for advancement so that their work is likely to pay off in the form of being able to both eat and clothe yourself and have a place to live.
Thank you.
Representative Slawik.
Mr. Chair, I didn't realize. Are there any more testimony then? Okay, I'll go pass at this point. Thank you.
Representative Grapple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very briefly, and kind of picking up on Representative Gazalka's comments earlier about root cause analysis and breaking it down to the family. Kind of, I mean, it's kind of sad looking at these numbers and, you know, putting faces on them. Kind of help me cope with this by brightening the mood. What do we have some programs out there that are able to rebuild families, that are able to, you know, get moms and dads back together again with their kids, kind of, you know, set that foundation so we can do the things like have people get jobs, have kids go to the same school, just do all the things we want them to do and have them stop doing the things we don't want them to do? Are we seeing some successes out there where we're able to do that, get families back together?
Representative, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. I do think that we have some successes. Let me just describe a couple. One of the successes that we have is that in the metro area as well as in greater Minnesota, the school districts are successful at getting homeless kids to school. 88% of the kids that were supposed to be in school because of their age on the day of our survey were actually in school. That's a really good success, and we certainly think that school is a good thing. Secondly, we know in Hennepin County they've been focusing a bit more on being able to help families just at the brink of homelessness to avoid shelter stays or avoid literal homelessness by intervening a bit earlier. And providing an assessment and services. I think that's a bright spot. But I think the general climate for nonprofits is a bit discouraging, frankly. Mm-hmm. We work for a nonprofit, the Wilder Foundation. Wilder operates 70 direct human service programs. We've seen our budgets cut in county contracts and state contracts for doing various services. We're right now struggling with a contract related to men and women exiting prison, and we think that there are public safety concerns related to this. If we can't find housing and reasonable jobs, that's a fast reentry into recidivism into the prison system. And I think if you ask representatives from any of the nonprofit sector that are trying to do those family rebuilding programs, they're finding it very difficult to scrape together the dollars now to actually deliver those services. So I guess my answer to you is there are programs that can deliver that kind of help, and there are a good number of them. And frankly, Minnesota is rich with both the means and the people inclined to work those programs. But I would say the general climate for funding for those programs is quite discouraging to most of them now.
And Mr. Chairman, if I one follow-up point, is and I want to be careful how I frame this because I want this to come across the wrong way, is that one of the things that I want to try to do when I'm here is I see all these people in like my district. I represent a suburban district, an exurban district, and we have lots of talent, lots of treasure out there. And what I'm trying to come up with is some sort of way we can get people to be more involved in the inner cities and be involved in their communities. And the best the one word example I can come up with for why we have to do this, and I hope there's no one from this city, but the word is Detroit. And for those people who have visited that area and they've seen what happens when the urban core just becomes a big black hole, it has profound effects for not just the city but the entire region. And I guess the thing I'm looking for is that, are you having successes of getting people from the suburbs to get involved, not just, you know, pay more taxes or donate more money, but actually participate and get involved in these families where they can actually be in a positive mentoring relationship? Or is this kind of outside your organization's scope and all?
Representative, Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. There are certainly a lot of people across the state that volunteer their time for various causes. One of the difficulties is that some of the situations that homeless individuals represent and the characteristics that I've described, they're not all that amenable sometimes to kind of volunteer kinds of help. Some of it is much more serious. It's chronic mental illness. Access to mental health services is a really significant issue in this population. And then I think that there are a lot of really well-inclined people in this state. I evaluate three of the Federal Compassion Capital Fund projects funded by the Bush White House, and we are evaluating programs in Montana, Tacoma, Washington, Phoenix, Arizona, Memphis, Tennessee, and Knoxville, Tennessee, as well as in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So we know that there is a great deal of compassionate behavior exhibited by people volunteering their time. But for some types of problems, the level of difficulty and distress requires more professional skill. And I would say, and for a number of the things that people need in homeless shelters, befriending, yes. I've seen a number of the church transitional housing programs that use volunteers from their churches to befriend and support individuals. That kind of support is critical. And I think probably there are ways to encourage more of it. But a lot of it, frankly, is, I think, a level of serious need that requires some level of significant training to be able to provide services adequately.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Sirich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the previous point we were talking about, the cost of housing, and not just in the Twin Cities area, but all across the state, and the individuals that are working full-time jobs that still cannot afford housing. We can sit in this committee and talk about the cost of housing. We can also talk about the wages that these people earn at the same time. I don't know if you want to comment on it, but with Jobs Policy Committee, last time I checked, there hasn't been a hearing on the minimum wage bill in the House of Representatives during my entire time here, and this is my fifth year. I know it's in the Commerce Committee. I don't know what it's doing in the Commerce Committee. You're the Jobs Policy Committee, Mr. Chair. I think you grabbed that bill. We finally have a hearing on it. The buying power of the of minimum wage is far below where it should be, and I think no matter where you sit on the issue, we should at least have that discussion. Because we can talk all we want about how much a house costs, but if you don't have the money to do it, it doesn't help. We have to talk about both sides of the issue, the actual buying power of these jobs, and then the cost of the housing. So maybe, Mr. Chair, if Representative Wilkins is going to sit on this bill again all through this year, as has happened in my 4 years here, and I'm just being pragmatic, maybe you can pull that bill out and we can have a hearing about it. Vote it up or down, I don't care, but at least have an honest discussion, and not just an anecdote, but an honest discussion with the bill before us on that issue. And maybe you want to comment on that as well.
I'd be glad to. It's my understanding that we are going to have a hearing in Representative Wilkins' committee. He's mentioned that to me as well as the GOP caucus.
Yep. My only comment would be, based on a previous survey that Ellen conducted with employers in the state of Minnesota, as part of the welfare reform study, we were examining inclination of employers to pay wages in different parts of the state and employ persons that recently exited welfare. I do think that the question of what state law requires in the way of wages or what kinds of expectations we have will influence employers. I think otherwise they're going to be completely driven by whatever market conditions based on the survey that Ellen conducted. Yes.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair. I'm not exactly sure where to start with this comment. I do want to respond to Representative Garofalo. Am I saying your name right, Garofalo?
Just call me Pat, that's fine.
Okay. Well, that's how to say it correctly. You know, there's just some things that we just shouldn't let go by. And two comments kind of disturb me. And I think you're open to dialogue because you said you didn't want to, you know, offend anybody. And so I'm taking that your word. And I want to start by inviting you to the inner city. You can come to my home. You can even stay overnight if you want, but you can come to my home. We'll go out to dinner. There was a time, I think, in 1989 or 88, we did a whole thing where it's probably time to do it again. I could just tell from different discussions that we've had here based on issues dealing with race, culture, that there's just lack of exposure that I think could be helped by people who... You were talking about people in the suburbs coming in and being an example to people in the inner city of how we should clean up our lives, kind of. And what I'd like you to know is, you know, they're very decent, good people in the inner city. And, you know, maybe we should export some of our richness of culture and strength and diversity to the suburbs. Some of that's happening anyway. But I just feel that the tone there was like, you know, we should come and somehow people from the suburbs should come and teach us in the inner city how to live. Right. And I think you had an unfortunate choice of words when you talked about Detroit as a big black hole. We know that it's predominantly an African-American.
Oh, that's not what I mean.
But nevertheless, just to have a dialogue here, you know, there's a lot of racial politics involved in Detroit. We know that. And we have racial politics going on here in our state. And so I just would like to get it on the table, Mr. Chair, because there have been comments, there were, you know, some comments the other day about Indian culture somehow needing to get fixed up. I just think that we might need to have some dialogue. And Mr. Chair, you're just about the best chairman I can think of to help us with this in some sort of, maybe this committee could do some sharing. I would personally like to invite anyone who would like to come and spend that hangout, you know, for some time in the city. I think other inner city legislators would do the same. And it was really, really helpful when we did that. We did it across party lines, you know. We had people, I was just called it, we did it on Valentine's Day, actually. I remember that we called it the Heart of the City or something. And we invited people in 88 to come and to actually, you know, see who the people are that live there. And I just feel like we're kind of at that point again. And I can tell you, I'm happy to exchange that. I spend a lot of time in rural Minnesota. That's where I come from. That's where my family is. I probably don't have as much time in suburban Minnesota, although I do have family. I go out to regularly to be with my nephews in suburban, you know, Ramsey, Tom Ramsey. So, I mean, there are just things that I think when we're dealing with very serious issues like this, talking about resources, we're talking about structures of families, we're talking about some of these issues, but Mr. Chair, I would just like to continue to see if we couldn't some way address some of these deeper issues, because I take it in good faith. I think you and others have been comments and what you were talking about too. I think there is good faith here. I always have to start. I wouldn't be doing this work if I didn't think our hearts and minds could be impacted and changed by each other, and that we could grow together. So I just want to raise that, Mr. Chairman. I just think we've come to a critical point, and we're going to be making some very serious decisions, and so if we can do that, I would like to help.
Mr. Chairman, could I just offer? And I don't mean to turn this into a group hub discussion or anything, but regarding the Detroit comment, in no way did I intend for that comment to come across as in any way referring to race being the problem in Detroit. As someone who's visited the city, Detroit, I can tell you from an economic development standpoint, from a downtown housing standpoint, Detroit's just a bad example of how to run a city. And it doesn't, frankly, it transcends race, the problems they're having there. And I want to avoid that in the Twin Cities. Regarding being involved in the cities, I would love that opportunity to come down. And just so you know, my background, and I know, you know, I've only been here a couple months, so you don't really know me. I have volunteered in Minneapolis before, and I tutored a kid who I met at Sharing and Caring Hands, and actually built a great relationship. And it was very enlightening for me just to realize how things are happening in the cities. And I think a lot of times my neighbors, people in the community I live with, they don't understand what's happening, specifically in Minneapolis. And literally, if we try to design a system to crank out broken kids, if we tried to make things wrong, I don't know if we could do it the way we're doing it right now. Pertaining to having respect for culture and for suburbanites coming in and telling people in the inner cities how to live, that is in no way my intention or comment. However, there are problems that are unique to the city right now, and culture is part of that. And referring to basic family units, I mean, the number of kids living in single-parent families in Minneapolis and St. Paul are just higher than they are in the suburbs. That's not a cultural issue. That's not a racial issue. That's a family structure issue. And whatever tools, whatever resources we can bring in, and Representative Clark, I'll be honest, I don't care what it costs, as long as we're solving the problem. No, but I want to be clear. Oh, there's your sound. That's the 5 o'clock news.
I agree with what you're saying, and I know your seriousness of bringing people to your district, and you've invited me before, and I've been in your district, even though you weren't there. But we will have that discussion at a later time. We got to refocus on what we have in this committee today, because we do have another testifier coming up. So,
congratulations, Mr. Chairman.
And you bring forth some very good points, and we will have a dialogue on that. Would you kind of wrap up for us, Mr. Owens?
I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I'll just make one closing comment and then ask Ellen if she's got a point to add or two. One thing, of course, that's been initiated in the last 18 months is the governor's task force to end long-term homelessness. And I just wanted to make a couple comments about that. Wilder was asked by Commissioner Marks to provide the information necessary to begin the planning, and we have provided the commissioner and the rest of the committee members with information related to the characteristics of those who are long-term homeless. And as I mentioned earlier, the definition is homeless for a year or longer, or homeless with multiple episodes over 3 years. We found in the examination of the data, and that is the one-page handout, if we could just hold that up, Ellen. There's another one-page handout, and this is only about the long-term homeless, so just so it's not too confusing. This is about the total population. This one is about the long-term homeless. The one comment I wanted to make about that is that the bonding issue that's before the legislature now is about essentially bricks and mortar. It's about building the housing, which of course is a very important thing. We do need housing. But at the same time, the level of disability that we see in this population, as I pointed out, about 85% have some type of serious disability, means that to support people in ways that are meaningful, to keep them out of trouble and potentially keep them in opportunities for employment and strengthen their opportunities for employment, requires some services. And where we hear both from the providers and from individual service recipients now, is that the level of support, the supportive services part, is going to be the very difficult part to sustain. I think actually we will be able to build to the bricks and mortar needs actually more easily than we will be able to sustain the supportive housing needs. And I'd take you right back to the Community Mental Health Act of the 70s when we deinstitutionalized. The promise was there'll be a place to live, and you will have access to treatment. And we really have to think hard about what we mean by the access to treatment and housing for the long-term homeless population. I really applaud Commissioner Marks and the committee. I know Commissioner Fabian is in that group, and Commissioner Goodnow. I really applaud the efforts of that group to try and develop a business plan for ending long-term homelessness. But I think you're going to hear a lot of questions and be asked to address needs that relate to the support needs of that population. Ellen, is there any other comments you want to add from the...
No, I guess the one thing I would mention is to try to answer Representative Garofalo's question about families. We don't have anything from the homeless study that addresses that, but I'm also involved in a group that's been trying to pull together everything we know about the results of welfare reform in Minnesota. And there's been a little bit of information out of the pilot version of MSIP that has some interesting findings about marriage formation. And so perhaps that would be something for the committee to be aware of and to find opportunities to learn from.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Next we have Next Decade of Housing Overview, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and Family Housing Fund. Please come. We've had a very lively discussion. I'm sure you'll continue it.
You actually had an excellent segue, and I'm going to pass around one other piece that I wasn't really planning to talk about, but because there was some interest in wages and housing costs, I just have a little additional handout here that has a nice chart on the back that you can peruse at your leisure.
It'll be a lively debate. Would you please give your name for the records? So we want to make sure everybody 100 years knows you were here.
Absolutely.
My grandchildren will be able to come up and see that.
Excellent. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Angie Skildum. I am the Research and Policy Director at the Family Housing Fund, and I'd like to start out with just telling you that I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee today. I'm here with Warren Hansen of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and I'll let him introduce himself further when he jumps in a few minutes. The Family Housing Fund, the organization that I work for, is a private nonprofit organization. Our mission is to preserve and expand quality affordable housing for low-income families in the metropolitan area, the seven-county metropolitan area. Since 1980, we have raised over $141 million in private investment and utilized those funds to help preserve and produce over 30,000 affordable housing units in the metropolitan area. As a funder, we raise private money from foundations and corporations to use for the production and preservation of housing. We play a couple of other roles as well. As a convener, we frequently bring people together from all sectors, government, nonprofit, for-profit, and work together to creatively develop solutions to meet affordable housing needs. And we also have a public education initiative where we provide information to community leaders and the general public about housing needs, and that's why I'm here today. This morning I'd like to give you a broad overview of affordable housing needs in Minnesota, and in order to do that I'm going to reference a couple of studies. The one that you see on your agenda is called The Next Decade of Housing in Minnesota. This is research done by a national market research firm called BBC Research out of Denver. I'm also going to talk a little bit about a study that we did locally with two local market research firms, Maxfield Research and GVA Marquette Advisors, that looks specifically at workforce housing needs and economic returns of the development of housing. And to close, I'm going to just introduce this little Family Housing Fund document that graphically represents the whole continuum of housing needs in the state. So that's a little bit of an outline of where we're going, and I'm going to start in, like I mentioned, with a study called The Next Decade of Housing in Minnesota. Like I said, BBC Research out of Denver was hired to produce this report for us. It was funded jointly by the State Housing Finance Agency, by the Family Housing Fund, and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and also done in cooperation with the Metropolitan Council. So there were a lot of local partners on the project. And the purpose of this research was to quantify affordable housing needs on a county-by-county basis in the state of Minnesota through the year 2010. What we wanted to do was to project and understand the demand for affordable housing in the state by income level and by household family type, singles, elderly, families with children, etc., in 2010, and then to understand the likely success or failure of the housing market to meet those needs, to meet that demand. And by the broader housing market, I mean both the private market and the public and philanthropic housing sector. And then knowing and understanding those two things to quantify what the unmet need for affordable housing would be in the state. The results were made available on several jurisdictional levels. There's a report that summarizes all the county-by-county information on a statewide level, and that's what I'm going to talk about today using those statewide numbers. There's also a 7-county metropolitan area report. There's an 80-county Greater Minnesota report that summarizes all of those counties together. And then there are a series of regional reports that provide the data and the results on that county-by-county basis. So if there's a particular jurisdiction that you're interested in, that information is available down to the county level. And all of that is available for your use on the MHFA's website. I'm not going to spend a lot of time this morning on the methodology that was utilized on this report. It's kind of easy to get bogged down in those details, and plus that information is available in the full reports on the MHFA website. But I will only say that to try to engage in this kind of work, projecting into the future needs is difficult, and the calculations were complicated, but the methodology itself was fairly straightforward, and here's what we did. We looked at several different sources to project the number of new low-income households that would be coming to Minnesota over that period of that decade, 2000 to 2010. By low-income households, we mean households earning less than 60% of the area median income in the metropolitan area or less than 80% of the area median income in Greater Minnesota. That was our starting point. All of those new households coming here will need a housing unit to live in. We subtracted from that number what we expect the private market to produce. And obviously the private market is a very important factor in the production of affordable housing. We continue to subtract what we expect the public and philanthropic sector to provide over the course of that decade. And that number equals the unmet need. The findings are in a series of really complicated tables in a handout that I gave you today, and I'm going to highlight a couple of things for you so that they're a little easier to understand. It starts out with the cover page of the report, and we're going to be looking at the first set of tables, which are titled Minnesota. This is statewide results. The first exhibit on your page here just simply shows the changes in the population at different income levels from the 2000 census and what we expect to see in 2010. So you can see in the bottom series there, change 20 to 2010, that we expect to have nearly 116,000 new low-income households coming to Minnesota over the course of the decade. But I want to focus in on Exhibit 2, which shows you the structure of the low-income housing market on the next page, and jump all the way to the bottom number on that page, 296,740 households, nearly 300,000 households. Those are people currently living in Minnesota that are cost-burdened right now. They're housed, but they're paying too much for their housing. By that, we mean they're paying more than 30% of their income for their housing expenses, and their low-income households. That threshold is kind of a national standard.
That's gross income or net income?
That's gross income.
Okay.
And it's a particularly good standard when you're talking about low-income households, people who aren't earning over you know, 80 to 100% of the area median income. Housing is typically the single largest expense in a family's budget, and if they're paying more than 30%, they're in a very precarious financial situation. And so that is the first very important finding from this study, that right now we have, like I said, nearly 300,000 households who are housed, but precariously housed. 171,000 of them are in the metro area, and 125,000 of them are in greater Minnesota. As I pointed out earlier, by 2010, we expect to have 116,000 additional new low-income households who are going to need affordable housing units. The study estimated that the private market, just functioning on its own, will provide units for about 49% of those households, or about 56,000 units. In addition to that, the study found that we expect the public and philanthropic sector, the state and organizations like the Family Housing Fund and Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and others, to produce about 26,000 units over the course of the decade. That leaves an unmet need in the state of Minnesota by 2010 of almost 33,000 affordable units. Again, just to give you an idea of the geographic distribution of those, about 22,000 of them would be needed in the metropolitan area, the seven counties, and about 11,000 would be needed in greater Minnesota. What are the implications of this 33,000 number? Well, it means that in order for us to fully address affordable housing needs in the state of Minnesota, first, we're going to need 33,000 additional housing units over and above what we're expecting to produce given current resources. Second, it means we're going to have to do something to help those existing 300,000 households who are housed but precariously housed. That may mean new construction. It may mean new vouchers, new rental assistance programs, or other programs. And third, it means we're going to have to preserve every single existing affordable housing unit that we have right now. And this is important because the study itself assumed no demolition and no conversion to market rate rent. That means that the state would... Minnesota's actually done well relative to other states around the country on this issue, but obviously you can see that this $33,000 unit shortage is quite a conservative estimate. If we lose any units, that would be an addition to the gap that we see right now.
There's no fires or anything.
No fires.
Representative Sturdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to that point, this does also not take into account any proposals by either the Plenty administration or the Bush administration on their potential cuts to housing on the federal and state level as well.
Representative, Mr. Chair, you have hit on the exact next point that I was going to make. Another extremely critical assumption that was made by this study when the research was done is that there would be a constant level of both public and private philanthropic investment in affordable housing.
How does Minnesota compare with other states?
In terms of...
our commitment to making housing, affordable housing, available.
Mr. Chair, I don't have at the top of my head knowledge of actual spending levels relative to other states, but I do believe that Minnesota is recognized as being very committed to affordable housing production, and that in fact we have some of the best and most coordinated systems, delivery systems, for both funding and the provision of housing and services relative to other states. That said, clearly we're not doing enough. We're projecting quite a large gap in affordable housing need at this point. And that gap, to your point, Representative, would only grow if at the national or federal, or state or local levels, there was a reduction in that commitment to affordable housing. That would clearly be moving in the wrong direction. That's kind of a quick broad brush overview of what the next decade of housing study, which took over a year to complete, came up with. And I want to shift gears just quickly from these broad need numbers to comment on another good reason to pay attention to this need and to do additional development, aside from the obvious benefits of providing a decent, safe, affordable place for all Minnesotans to live, I'd also like to point out some of the economic benefits to the state of addressing this need, both at the level that we do now and hopefully in increased levels in the future. And in order to do that, I'm going to reference a study that was funded, again, by the Family Housing Fund and the State Housing Finance Agency in partnership with the Metropolitan Council and the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. This was done in 2001, so it's a couple of years old, and it focuses exclusively on the metropolitan area. But it still has some really, I think, useful information to think about. This particular study focused on workforce housing needs. And by workforce housing, we're talking about housing for people that are earning between $15,000 and $50,000 a year. So that's a little over $7 an hour to close to $20, I think. We did identify needs specifically for workforce housing units in the metropolitan area. They don't exactly match up with the greater, the statewide study that I just talked about because it was done at a different time with a different methodology looking at a different jurisdiction. But we do know from the BBC study that more than half of the units that are identified as gap need, there's 33,000 units, more than half of them would be needed for people that would be considered workforce housing households, earning greater than 30% of the area metropolitan income. So it's an important constituency to really consider consider those workforce housing needs. What I really wanted to draw your attention to from this study was its focus on the economic benefits and the return on investment of the delivery of affordable housing. And what this study found was that failing to address workforce housing needs results in both lost consumer spending in the metropolitan area and lost business income. Conversely, addressing workforce housing needs adds jobs, workers, wages, and development and assessment fees to state and local government. So there's great economic justification in doing this work, and specifically, the study estimated that in the metropolitan area only, there would be about $3 billion in net benefit in fully developing housing for workers in the metropolitan area over the course of the construction phase, and then $1 billion in net ongoing benefit thereafter. So after the construction work is done, those jobs have ended, there's still that additional consumer spending and business income that would be generated by the workers who'd be living in those units. And by net benefit, I mean benefit over and above any subsidy that would be required to actually produce those units. So you can see that, and that's just, again, in the metropolitan area. Clearly those numbers would be even bigger when you would look at them on a statewide basis. And clearly affordable housing production and preservation is a very important component of our state's economy. So I just wanted to draw your attention to that study as well.
Representative Surtich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we're talking about workforce housing, I just have a question for Mr. Soderberg with the governor's recommendation for workforce housing. Do you recall the dollar figure, the cut dollar figure of what's proposed for Housing Finance Agency as it pertains to workforce housing?
Mr. Soderberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Surtich, I'm not really sure how you'd qualify out of the proposal what is workforce housing, but the total dollar amount net for housing finance is $15 million in the governor's proposal over the course of the two fiscal years.
Cuts of $15 million.
$15.
Okay. And that point, what effect would that have then? Are you able to quantify that at all, what a cut like that would do?
Representative, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass this over to Warren, but the Housing Finance Agency has quantified it to say that that will be a reduction of 50% in the number of workforce housing units that they'll be able to produce with that money. But at this point, I'd like to pass it over to Warren, give him a chance, and maybe to speak further to that issue.
Mr. Hansen, welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, my name is, members of the committee, my name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. Well, let me just jump right into that question. As Angie said, MHFA itself and essentially the administration indicates that the current proposed cuts to the Challenge Fund program of $13 million plus other programs being cut would reduce the production by about 50%. We've looked at the numbers for the past 10 years for the multifamily portion of the production that's been supported by the Challenge program. And a little over 9,200 units have been produced of multifamily rental housing by the Challenge program in the last 10 years. If you average that out, that's about 900 and some a year. And if that production drops, that means about 450 households or families per year will not have access to affordable rental housing and will either be cost burdened or live in unsafe, unsound housing, or perhaps just have fewer housing options or less stable housing. If you quantify that over the course of 10 years, obviously that's about 4,500 units of housing that this state will not be able to provide or help provide, along with the private sector and philanthropy, which also provide, the bulk of the money, actually. Mm-hmm. What I would like to do is just direct your attention to this little packet that you have and talk about some of the need that is not specifically addressed in the BBC study. If you look at this chart shows us on the front the difference between the rise in home prices and the rise in wages, just on a percentage basis. And it looks at it by every region of the state, all six outstate regions in the Twin City metro area. And as you can see by the large bars in the back, home prices have been going up on average 2 to 3 times as fast as wages. And wages are lagging. As that continues to increase and wages do continue to stagnate and home prices for some reason do continue to rise very sharply, there's a greater need for affordable housing. If you look at the next chart, this is an example of the kind you're asking about what people can afford and the gap between what they can afford and what it really costs. What we've got here are some essential worker, some representation of what is Minnesota's essential workforce. The essential workforce is described as unskilled and semi-skilled workers that are essential to any viable economy. It would include the firefighters, the nursing aides, the regular laborers, emergency medical technicians, and those are represented on the left. Both people are making $14 an hour or less, and they can roughly afford an $80,000 mortgage or rents of about $800. If you go to the right, you can see what home prices are at in different parts of the state, and they're typically in the range of $120,000 for existing homes to $160,000 to $200,000 for new homes, and that's at the bottom end of the market. So there's a huge gap between what our workforce can typically afford and what homes are costing in today's marketplace. What I'd like to jump to is the next page where I'd like to indicate something that's not well recognized or well known or even greatly appreciated, and that is the fact that in the last 8 or 10 years we have been able to, along with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, garner an awful lot of employer support for affordable housing. We've been able to do that because we've expanded this partnership between or beyond the state and what the legislature provides to the MHFA every year and what philanthropy has been providing every year, and been able to recruit and attract employers. To date, just in Greater Minnesota, this number would go up by millions if we looked at the metro too. Just in Greater Minnesota, we've been able to attract $18.5 million from employers like Mayo Clinic and Schwann's and Hormel and hundreds, really, of others to produce about 1,500 units just with employer involvement. The next page is the list of employers. A lot of them are from areas that you and your colleagues represent. The very, very fine print over there that you probably can't read is a list of over 100 employers just from the Rochester area alone that joined with Mayo Clinic to come up with a total of $11 million, an unheard of, nationally unheard of amount of money to produce about 875 units of workforce housing.
Is Bishop's name in there? I can't read.
I think it is. So that just underscores the importance of the Challenge Fund dollars, because the Challenge Fund dollars are so incredibly flexible that we're able to really create a range of housing types. I want to just touch on a couple of other things, because I know our time is just about running out. I know the chairman and others on the committee are interested in cost reduction and delivering affordable housing in the most efficient way possible. And we've been working very hard at doing that, again, with the agency, using a program called Building Better Neighborhoods, which has been providing incentives and a lot of technical assistance to about 50 communities around the state to do more compact lots, more cost-effective building techniques, more efficient use of infrastructure to bring the cost of homes down. St. Peter and many other communities are...
Marshall was
also one of those. You can just kind of skim through the information there, but we've been able to reduce the cost of homes by $10,000 to $20,000 by using these cost reduction techniques. In Alexandria alone, the combination of those cost reduction techniques saved $750,000 on 71 units of housing. And that money that's saved, by the way, when we do these cost reduction techniques, saves government money. It saves state dollars that would have to go in as subsidy or philanthropic dollars to achieve the affordability. So we're saving the state. The state is being saved a lot of money by the application of those techniques. I'm going to skip the wealth creation of home ownership. You're all aware of how important it is for every family to, if it's possible, to get into home ownership and gain equity over time. Yeah. I would just say that For the families that we've been able to help, again, through the Challenge Program, for just a couple of $1,000 of down payment over the course of 30 years, making monthly payments on home ownership with appreciation and so forth, that family builds equity of $300,000 and upwards of that, which is then used over, you know, in the end, again, saving the state money for education and retirement and self-sufficiency at various stages of a family's life, whether it be early in the family's life or later on in retirement when everybody needs those kinds of resources. I'd like to just have you look at the last chart here, and this is going back to the BBC study, and it just takes a look at the numbers that Angie provided you. If you look at the middle section of that bar, shows that 26,000 units would be produced by ongoing or continued, assuming a continued support by the state and continued funding levels by foundations. That's what would be produced. That was the assumption. If the Challenge Fund is cut, that number is going to go down by over the next 10 years. By easily 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 if you combine single family and multifamily. And this number of the unmet need will go up. I want to close by saying that I think we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that the governor is providing really excellent leadership on supportive housing and ending long-term homelessness. He's providing a mix of capital dollars, or proposing a mix of capital dollars, a mix of operating dollars, and service dollars. And that's exactly what is needed to address long-term homeless needs and to create viable supportive housing. I would just say that the challenge cuts are going to be hard on working families and hard on our ability to maintain the economic vitality of communities around the state. And it's going to take away our ability to attract employers and keep employers at the table. And we've been more successful, I think, than probably any state in the country in recent years at getting major employers to come to the table out of their sense of cooperation and civic duty and self-interest, enlightened self-interest and civic-mindedness. And we'll lose a lot of our ability to do that. Granted, there will still be some challenge money, but we will lose our ability to do that. So I'll close with that.
Certainly I agree that the challenge money has been the centerpiece in what we've been relying on. And I just was handed a sheet by Michael Dahl that points out something very clear to me, Angie, is that our vacancy rate in Minnesota is so low that it's causing the price of housing to be so high. The demand for housing is great, so we have to produce more housing in order to make free up more money and free up more housing for workers. I'm starting to see that relationship. Thanks,
absolutely,
to you. Thank you very much. Representative Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To your last comment, when you talk about the governor's initiative for ending long-term homelessness and supportive housing and applauding that,
mm-hmm,
but then going into your comments of saying how hard it's going to be for the challenge grant with the cut,
mm-hmm,
I want you to know, and maybe others to realize that, and maybe you do already, is by applauding the governor, you're also supporting the cuts of the challenge grant, because in his proposal, he directly finds the $13 million from the challenge grant to fund supportive housing. So there's, and I'm not meaning to offend, there's a bit of hypocrisy there by the governor. By supporting his initiative on homelessness, he's taking away from the challenge grant at the same time. So it's really, you know, pick what you need. We need them both, but he's putting us in a precarious position to choose, and your comments reflect that, and it's very, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but that's the difficult portion of this, is we can applaud the governor's initiative when he's causing a problem at the same time in the challenge grant.
Okay, last question. Representative Slaw.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I just want to thank you for having a whole hearing on homelessness and housing. I think if we really could solve homelessness and look at the root causes and look at the services that we truly need and look at that level of affordable housing, we'd go a long way to what this committee really needs to do. So my last comment is just to say I hope we look at this further, and I'm glad we took the time to do it.
Okay, Representative Clark, one more second. Okay. Angie, go ahead.
If I could just make one closing comment. There's a chart that's attached to my handout that I didn't get to talk about, but it demonstrates the continuum of housing needs from shelter to supportive housing to generic affordable rental, low and moderate homeownership programs, and then higher income homeownership programs. And that is just to help this committee, as you consider all of those housing needs. A holistic housing policy needs to address all of those areas, and a hole in any one area will just create a greater need elsewhere in that continuum.
We got to get some way to keep that inflation from getting less than 17% a year. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.